So if you're just visiting for this first time, we're ending a year-long exploration around the 10 paramis. So these 10 perfections or these 10 qualities have been a teaching theme. So each year we pick a teaching theme that we use to kind of bring a cohesiveness throughout the year as the different teachers rotate through Monday nights and Sundays and Thursdays and all the events. So it kind of brings a quality of connectedness to it. So the 10 paramis, if you're not familiar with, are generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. So each one of those we took a month to really dive into, to explore. And this month we've been exploring them as a whole, and last couple of weeks exploring kind of the distortions we can come around, kind of identification with these paramis. And next year, starting next month in a few weeks, just less than a week, we'll be exploring the Four Noble Truths as a teaching thing. Right? So the Four Noble Truths represent kind of the foundational teachings, kind of the keystone teachings of the Dharma, of the Buddha. It's really, why do we practice? That's the ultimate quite answer to that is around the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, there is the end of that suffering, there's origination of suffering, end of the suffering, and the path to that suffering. So I thought tonight it'd be a nice way to kind of basically transition from paramis into the Four Noble Truths, to start to show you some of the connections there are with them. The more I looked at it, the more I saw the connections. At first I thought there wasn't very many. So these paramis, as we've just finished exploring this year, they're both expressions and also cultivations of our practice. Okay, so there's things we can practice. We can practice loving kindness. We can practice renunciation, generosity. We can bring an intentionality to how to bring that into our lives. And they also can be a natural fruit or expression of our maturity of our practice. We start to find ourselves just naturally being more truthful, or maybe having a quality of equanimity arising when it normally wouldn't have. And those are always nice to notice, to really appreciate about yourself, to appreciate how your heart is starting to change with practice. Now, some of these paramis are really focused on our external relationships to people, around generosity, around ethics, truthfulness, loving kindness, and equanimity. They tend to really show up relationally. While others perhaps can also be seen more internally, our own internal cultivation of wisdom, of our practice, like renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, and resolve. Of course, each one of those, we could see it both inwardly and outwardly. There's an outward expression, and there's also an inward expression of each of these. Now, last couple weeks, we've been exploring some of the distortions that have come around the paramis, because we put a list like, call it the perfections. It's easy to say, okay, I want that. I want to perfect that. It's like getting my merit badges or something. I want to check them off, or I want to, you know, adopt a sense of image, self-image that's based around those paramis. And that sometimes can come from a place of distortion, especially denial of our humanness. But many of those, if not all of them, fall away if we have wisdom along with that, if we bring wisdom along with how we explore each of these paramis. They can really help to counterbalance that. As I explored the last couple of weeks, things like mindfulness, investigation, concentration, all those qualities help us to become more self-honest, to actually see what's actually present, and to see how our image of self or our self-belief might be kind of tied to that, and how it creates a subtle distortion around these paramis. Now, that's kind of what we've been exploring this last year. Now, as we move into the next year, and this is New Year's time, these Four Noble Truths are really the keystone of wisdom in our practice. In this tradition, it said that's the first talk that the Buddha gave was around the turning of the wheel, talking about these Four Noble Truths. right? That there is dukkha. There is origination of that dukkha, cessation of that dukkha, and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. So you're going to dive into that a little bit more, kind of lightly touch on each of those. Now, they all revolve around this word dukkha. Okay, dukkha is often translated as suffering, but in our culture, that sometimes isn't a sufficient translation, because we sometimes feel like, okay, I'm not really suffering in this moment, because we don't recognize the suffering that's there. And then, you know, and so we kind of miss that. An important part of dukkha is that it's actually something that's impermanent, something that's insubstantial. And this helps us understand that things which might be pleasurable in the moment, or a pleasurable state of mind, or a meditative state, or a self-image, or a role, or possession, whatever it might be, ultimately that is impermanent. Ultimately that will end and fade away. And the more attached we are to that, the more suffering comes from that. And so that's one of the key pieces, is that attachment. So dukkha, there's this sutta where the Buddha is speaking to some of the kind of the cosmology in Buddhist thought, that there's different lifetimes and different kind of realms of existence. And, you know, whether you believe in that or not, that's, you know, I think we can also use it as a metaphor just for our own lives. But there's different states that he would speak to that, okay, when you get to this state, it's more and more sublime pleasure and enjoyment. And it lasts for longer and longer periods, the deeper you go. And yet, after each one of them, he said, and that too is dukkha. That too is impermanent, right? So if you celebrated Christmas and you got this great gift, there's this kind of joy in it, but yet that too is going to be broken or lost, or you no longer be able to use it at some point. And the more kind of attached we are, the more suffering we'll feel from that, right? So there's the attachment, there's the fact of impermanence, then substantiality. So suffering is just one aspect of this concept or this idea of dukkha. And then the three noble truths really revolve around this. The first one is that there is dukkha, recognizing it. And the second noble truth is that there is an origin. It's not just arbitrary. It actually comes up in relationship to our attachment, for example. But the good news is the Buddha said there actually that is optional. There's a level of that suffering which is optional. And that's the realm of our practice. That's what makes practice possible. That's why we practice. That's why he decided to teach some 2,600 years ago. Because you could actually see through that dukkha. And the fourth noble truth is the pathway to that. Now, if you haven't seen, if you're here in room, I see a number of you saw that little card that Cheryl and Tuari made up with some help from Carrie, and this describes the the teaching theme. They also have each of the noble truths have these insights. We can think of it almost as three insights for each truth, and generally we can say the first one is just recognition that there is this truth. The second insight is the practicing of it, the integration of it, trying to see for yourself. And the third one is to actually know, okay, I actually do understand this in a deep way. This actually transformed me, there's a realization of that noble truth. You can think of it as a movement from the intellectual understanding to this very deep knowing. This deep knowing that actually changes our very way we are in the world, changes the way that we perceive ourselves and others. It's a shift of that pattern of ignorance or delusion. And then how to cultivate these four noble truths is the fourth noble truth, which is also the Eightfold Path. All right, so I think I read someplace that the human mind can only hold seven things, so I've already given you 10 paramis, four noble truths, and now Eightfold Path. So if it's too much to hold all at once, don't worry about it. Just take what's helpful, you know, and we'll be kind of really working with this throughout this year. So Eightfold Path also includes the recognition, includes the cultivation, and the maturity. Now, it's interesting as you look at these two lists, they seem like they're kind of not much overlap, right? And one way you can look at it is the paramis are this almost positive expression of our practice through things like generosity, through loving kindness, through equanimity, through truthfulness. There's these positive manifestations. When we look at the Four Noble Truths and you look especially at the Eightfold Path, a lot of it's kind of more framed in the negative, right? So like wise action is not causing harm. Wise speech is having this of not lying and being not idle. There's all of these kind of negative ways of describing it. Now, there's this book called What the Buddha Taught by Ruhula, and he addressed this question we often see. He's like, why not phrase everything in the positive? It's because the positive, the mind can make an idea around it. It can become something that it's out there that I'm trying to obtain. And it can build in all our will, our desire, all that kind of qualities that can cause some distortions. It's easier to misinterpret. But if you say what it's not, that kind of leads you to this place of, okay, it allows it to actually arise and be seen directly. So both have their place, both have their role. Because we also need that aspiration. We need that sense of faith and that heart's yearning as the paramis can often draw us forth. So as I said, we can use the paramis really as a way to cultivate wisdom. So if you think of the Four Noble Truths as really this expression of wisdom, the paramis themselves can help us cultivate wisdom through their practice. You know, what does it really mean to be generous? What does it mean to really have loving kindness? You know, not the idea or the self-image of that, but the actual, the deep realization of it, equanimity, the same way. We can also use the paramis to allow us to express that understanding, to express that quality of wisdom that just comes forth. And that's often, and if you've practiced for any length of time, you start to see this in your life. You start to see that there's ways, defaults that you used to have, ways of reactivity, of judgment, of contraction of heart, that start to slough off, that start to fall away. It's not necessarily because you chose to stop doing them. It just somehow they just don't make sense. It's almost like the machinery that made that possible, like someone took one of the gears out. So it starts to load up and it just kind of comes to a stop. And instead something else comes forth. It's often a little surprising. It's like, wow, I'm actually relating to this situation, this person in a different way than I normally would. That's part of the maturity of your practice. That's part of the fruition of your practice. I think it's helpful to reflect on that, to share it with you fellow Dharma practitioners. That kind of brings a sense of brightness of heart, brings enthusiasm, brings a quality of energy for the practice. So you start to see that the paramis and wisdom, the Four Noble Truths, really start to interrelate. So let's just lightly go through these Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, in a light way, not too deep, and just start to draw some of the connections. So as we move into the Four Noble Truths in a really committed way this next year, use this whole year of practice around the paramis to inform that, to connect those dots. So the first noble truth, that there is dukkha, there is suffering. So this is such an essential way to start practice. Just because if any profession you might have, or let's say we take medicine, the medical model of diagnosing, if you don't know what the problem is, you don't know what the disease is, you're going to throw different solutions at it. Right? But if you really recognize that what the disease is or the issue is or the problem is, if you see it in a very clear way, then you can see the cause of it. You can see the solution, the cure of that. So recognition and understanding of this, of where this problem is. So again, we'll talk much more about this each month. First month would be dukkha. Second month would be the second noble truth. Now, suffering is interesting because there's different elements of it. Because sometimes when I hear myself talk about the cessation of suffering, does that mean I never feel physical pain again if I become awakened? Does this, the Buddha, did he ever feel physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain after he became awakened? Okay, the answer is yes. He did feel those. He did continue to feel those at different levels. But there's something that started to fall off of that. Something that made it less intense. There's different levels of dukkha. There's the dukkha of dukkha, dukkha-dukkha, as it's often called. This is the ordinary dukkha of us having physical bodies, right? We stub our toe. We hurt our backs. We hurt our knees. And we lose people. You know, we lose loved ones. There's suffering that arises from that. There's the dukkha that's around the sense of impermanence, this fact that things are changing. Right? Think about roles in your life, which you have really cherished. And those roles end. They change at some point. Maybe it's a profession that you really enjoyed and you had to retire. Maybe it's having your children at a certain age and they grow out of that. Maybe it's the health of your body diminishing. There's all these relationship ending. So many different examples of this level of impermanence. And there's also the suffering that comes from just the mental quality, the mental angst, the mental worry, the mental sense of difficulty. Let's try to think. The insight timer, I don't know if you use that. What was the quote today? Does anyone remember? He was kind of talking to that. Like, yeah, so worrying is like betting against yourself. Yeah, nice. So this first noble truth, how does this relate to the paramis? So wisdom is a big part of that. The wisdom to recognize when there actually is dukkha, when there is suffering. Not to be confused about that. Renunciation. We start to see suffering in a more clear way. We start to not want to keep adding that to ourselves or to our loved ones. Ethics often grow from that. When we really see the impact of our actions, we really see the suffering that's caused by our ethical misconduct or our distortions or our reactivity. If we really take that in, that provides a level of motivation for ethics, which is very deep and very profound. Energy can come from that. A sense of resolve can come from seeing dukkha so clearly. So dukkha, I think it's very wise that we start there. We start with that as a realization, understanding that more and more clearly. So the second noble truth, that there is an origin of dukkha. So it's not just happenstance. It actually arises often because of our actions or our ways of distortion. And some of that dukkha we experience is self-inflicted. It's self-caused. And that's really the part of Dharma that starts to transform. An obvious expression of this is the second arrow teaching. So this is a very graphic but practical way of describing this, that if I walked around and I stubbed my toe, I would feel pain in that toe. That's that first arrow of pain. It doesn't matter if you've never practiced or if you're the Buddha, you're still going to feel that pain. You have a human body. But what happens if we haven't practiced, we add a whole lot of extra suffering to that. I start to yell and rant and say, who left this table here? How could they be so careless? Or I turn it inward. How could I be so clumsy? So I've added more suffering to something that's already painful. I've amplified it. I've expanded it. That is actually optional. If we can actually just feel the sensations of that first arrow without adding the second arrow. A little less obvious is a misunderstanding of reality, of the cause of this, of dukkha. This is when we see something which we think is We misperceive what is actually dukkha. We see something which we think is very beautiful, and we think it's permanent and never going to change. And it's not. It's actually something that isn't so beautiful. That misperception causes suffering. The second one is around that impermanence, as I just mentioned. We think something's going to be permanent, and it no longer is. Right? So let's say we have an injury that we used to be very active and healthy, and then we have an injury, and suddenly our capacity drops down. Something we took for granted, something that we didn't realize how attached we are to that self-image has changed. There is suffering from that. And the final one is that we mistake that which is empty of self as being full of self. Right? So this gets a little bit deeper and deeper in the deep waters of the Dharma. But basically, we can see this in a superficial level, that a role of your life, a identity, you know, maybe you're physically healthy, active, maybe you have a relationship, maybe you have a job, maybe you have a bank account or some possession, and it really defines who and what you are. And you don't even realize that until that's taken away. It falls away. And then there's suffering that arises from the loss of that identification. So that's kind of a big example, large, easy to see. We can get very, very subtle with that. Another way this is described is the second noble truth is described as tanha. This is a word that's often translated as thirst or hunger. This hunger to become or hunger not to become. Also hunger for sense pleasure. So that's, sometimes we get a little hung up on that, that means I can't have any sense pleasure if I'm a Buddhist practitioner. That's not true. It's more your attachment to it. Attachment is where the issue comes in. So again, February, we'll really dive into this one. The third noble truth is the sensation of dukkha. This is the good news. This is what makes it all worthwhile practicing. Otherwise, it's kind of depressing at this point. there's dukkha and there's all the causes of dukkha. But to realize there's actually an end to that dukkha, there's a sensation of dukkha. There is an ending. So there's small releases of this, there's large releases of this. I forgot the equanimity, going back into the paramis. So equanimity is part of this, patience is part of this, wisdom, renunciation. Really renouncing in a deep way that which causes suffering. Second Noble Truth has many of the same paramis of generosity, of truthfulness, wisdom, renunciation, ethics, resolve. They all can come forth as we try to practice each of these four noble truths. And paradoxically, or a nice, you know, kind of, I don't know if it's paradox, but a nice compliment is that those are also expressions of these understandings. The more we understand the second noble truth, the more the generosity comes forth, the more the truthfulness comes forth. And the sensation of dukkha, it's important to also recognize kind of the small ways that starts to show up, the small ways we become less attached, when there's a way of abiding with the moment, like we don't have to change the moment. There's a sense of peace that's outside of conditions. Right? So that starts to come forth more and more. And there's also the more mature, deep ways that shows up, when that sense of self is actually seen through in a very clear, direct way. It's actually no longer present. And in that absence, there's a different level of peace and a different level of interconnection that arises from that. And on to the fourth noble truth. The fourth noble truth is the practice of this, the path to this. And this really you can see the connections with the paramis. So the first of the Eightfold Path is really the wise view. This wise view, wise understanding. Sometimes we call it the right understanding, right view, wise or right, both are used interchangeably. And a simple way to think of it is the right view or wise view is understanding the four noble truths. understanding that there is dukkha, there's origination, and there's a sensation. Right? So that their wise view orients us to how we act in the world. It orients us to how we show up in the world. Actually orients to how we interpret the world and in some ways create the world. Right? So we can think of an unwise view is if I always thought people were out to get me. There's a sense of paranoid, sense of being criticized. It's easy to interpret other people's actions and words as criticism. Right? So that's a way that I've actually shaped the world to fit that belief. Right? You have a deeper, the wise view actually sees the nature of sufferings come from this place of wisdom. The wisdom parami is really developed in this, how dukkha arises, how it ceases. So from wise view, we move to wise intention. So this is connecting our understanding with starting to be this connector into our actions, right? Which is the third path factor. So intentionality precedes any action that we do, any action of the body, any action of the mind, any action of our verbiage or our communication. There's an intentionality that precedes it. Sometimes we're conscious of it, sometimes we're not. Sometimes we get reactive and we lash out because we're afraid or angry. Sometimes we have an intentionality of desire or greed that follows our actions. Sometimes there's an intentionality of generosity and that flows from that way. So there's three main intentions, wise intentions of non-harm, non-greed, and non-ill will. So you can see how those really map nicely over the paramis. The non-harm comes from the place of ethics. The non-greed comes from a place of generosity. So it's like the positive way of describing it. Non-ill will, loving kindness. Loving kindness. Also, non-greed has a renunciation quality, renouncing that which is we're kind of clinging to. So from intentionality, we move to wise action. So wise action, as I just mentioned, isn't just what we do with our bodies, it's not just what we do with our hands, but also what we do with our communication, whether it's through our words or through our emails or our texts or direct messaging. And then also mentally, is how our minds work. Because that's an action also. Actions mean that we're kind of reinforcing patterns. We're expressing this intentionality. So the wise actions go back to, actions of body, mind, and spirit, back to ethics. So the parami of ethics come right in there. Then there's wise speech, truthfulness. Not speaking that which is not true, but also expressing what is true, the beneficialness of that which is shared, the timing of that. There's also some other things around gossip and those kind of things. Wise livelihood. Back to ethics. Can we base our life in one that's not causing harm? Is that's kind of the bottom line. Sometimes we get a little sometimes talk to students who struggle a bit with their profession and wonder, is it a wise livelihood? And I think a wise livelihood, first of all, if it is actively causing harm, if you're really in that's actively learning how to kill people or cause, death and destruction, that's definitely in this arena. The other arenas get a little bit more of a gray area. What's a wise livelihood? And I think if you find yourself able to be engaged, your heart comes forth, you feel like you're able to connect, almost any profession can offer that. And so sometimes we get a little idealistic that I have to have this, purely no harm at all. But any profession that we do, there's going to be some level of harm. If you drive to work, maybe you're causing harm to the environment. We can get a little too tight around it sometimes. But again, we'll have a whole month to explore that. Wise effort, the next path factor. One nun talked about wise effort is like where the rubber hits the road. It's this interface with how do we actually bring all this understanding, how we bring our energy to bear. So this definitely connects with the paramis. It's not exactly the same Pali word, but it relates to energy. It relates to resolve, this wise effort. Also patience too. You know, sometimes this wise effort refers to meditative qualities and how do we release what is unwholesome? How do we allow what's wholesome to start to arise? And patience is a part of that. And patience is a sense of letting things unfold at their own time, their own pace. And sometimes we feel like we have to force that. And this is one of the big things as meditators we have to learn is what is the wise effort? How does that change as our understanding changes? I remember when I first started to practice, I spent a lot of effort just trying to find the breath. The mind just getting lost in thought, again and again and again, coming back with patience. And the wise effort starts to become much softer, much more relaxed as our understanding grows. All right, two more. Wise mindfulness. So wise mindfulness, we don't see it really pulled out in the paramis in a clear way. It doesn't actually, it's not one of the paramis. And yet mindfulness is what makes the paramis work. To be able to be present, to be connected, to know what's arising. Actually be present enough to see and perceive. So equanimity is part of that. Just as we started the meditation, kind of connecting with a sense of stillness, a sense of quiet that's so prevalent this time of year, that holds whatever is arising with a quality of balance, with a quality of equanimity. It doesn't really matter what arises in this experience. If we relax in that stillness, is able to hold it in a moment-by-moment perspective. And wise concentration, again, not directly represented, but without some level of concentration, we can't really land and see what's here. We can actually perceive these deeper roots of confusion, of delusion, of ignorance. And that concentration is helpful, is very needed. And these all cycle back and help wisdom to grow, as we'll explore when we get into that. So the paramis and the Four Noble Truths can seem like very different lists, but hopefully you start to see how they really are interrelated. They very much support each other, depend upon each other. Each have their own the elements which echo and represent each other. Because if we spent all our time focusing on meditation and cultivating wisdom and never really bring it into our lives, that's a very limited practice. Now, if I just said, my practice is just going on retreats, my practice is just my daily meditation period, and I don't forget about the rest of my days, it's very limited. I think it's probably maybe impossible to keep it so isolated, really, because you're learning to practice to be present that tends to bleed over and connect with the rest of your life. And the Buddha really linked these two, how we act in the world and how our meditation grows and deepens is really interrelated. Eightfold Path clearly demonstrates that. And the paramis are just another way of practicing our insights, practicing our understanding, learning to cultivate that understanding. So daily life with all its struggles, its disappointments, dukkha arises. Can we learn to turn toward that so it becomes a source of wisdom, of understanding? Can we transform our way of being in the world? All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle, and then we'll have a chance for any sharing or questions you might have. And underneath all the words, there's a lot of words, a lot of lists. There's still this present moment and how it's arising. The sounds, the sensations, thoughts. kind of meet that with a quality of full-heartedness, a quality of presence. And let the response come from wisdom, from compassion. That's the shorthand of the whole talk. All right, thank you for your kind attention. So we have a chance for any questions or sharing you might have. So if you're here in the room, you can raise your hand and we'll bring a mic over so you can, we can hear you online. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand so we can call on you. I know I threw a lot of lists at you tonight. It's kind of, you know, if you have new to all of this, that it just starts to kind of be the first way of hearing about it, interpreting it. And then I think after this next year, you have a deeper understanding of each of these Four Noble Truths. Yes.
So, hello, can you hear me? Okay. I came in this evening, with kind of a question that I was trying to formulate in my head. Yeah. And, you kind of answered it partially with your talk tonight. It was about, the part where, you find like parts of like your old self kind of just like fade away. Mm-hmm. And like you don't need them anymore and stuff like that. And, I suppose, my pondering when it comes to that is there are parts of myself that I've noticed fade away that definitely might have been like more on the toxic side. Like I had a really high level of like resolve and conviction in my life and like with what I was doing with my life. And with that, sometimes it came, you know, anger might come alongside those when, you know, that, when that's challenged. And I've found that that's been, as I've been practicing over the last year or so, that's been fading away and it's definitely brought about more peace. But there's still like a very small ego that's like lamenting the loss of those qualities. Yeah. And I think part of that is because that was a part of my identity that I had. So, I don't know exactly what my question was supposed to be, but it's just something I wanted to kind of mention and discuss.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. So honestly, and it's like one way you can look at practice is it starts to quiet down the expression of the patterns, the kind of investment in it. And that quieting down allows us to see it in a more clear, direct way, you know, a more accurate way. And that little bit of like, okay, I kind of miss that part of me. I miss that sense of, you know, it's really a quality of empowerment, a sense of engagement, like, okay, I'm really engaged here. So that's, I often think of that as the second noble truth of the Tanha, that hunger to be, that hunger to manifest. Now, so that we can sometimes get into distracted actually by the Buddhist concepts because there's so many of them and they're like, okay, where am I in this? But if you can actually, you know, take that and reinterpret the teachings, how it's actually showing up in your life, that's really powerful, right? One way to look at it is when you're not acting on those patterns, you're much less defined. You're much less identify, you're not taking form in the same way. And there's a part of us, sometimes, you know, it's really, there's a lot of unconscious momentum to this that doesn't like that, that likes to be formed. So sometimes noticing that, just realizing, oh, this is this hunger to form, this hunger to be, right? So it kind of begs the question, if you're not being that pattern, what are you? And who are you? And what defines you? And often there's this kind of in-between place, this limbo that when we're starting to see the patterns fall away, but we haven't really deeply seeing what we actually are outside of those patterns. And it was like, okay, at least I knew what I was, even though it was causing lots of havoc, but at least I was defined, you know. And we haven't really opened that. And that's one way to work with it. I really appreciate this way of approaching it, is when you see that pattern arise, sometimes it's easy to see it as a problem to overcome, to get rid of. But sometimes bowing to it and saying, wow, thank you for serving me, helping me define myself, helping to create that sense of self in such a strong way. What that does is transforms me from relating to it as a problem, something to get over, to a place of connecting with, a sense of compassion, a sense of understanding. And then something starts to let go. If we stop fighting with it, it starts to soften. Right? And then the mystery is, well, what am I if I'm not that? And that is much harder to define. Right? Because when you're angry, you know exactly who and what you are. You know what your opinions are. But if you're not angry, or if you're the opposite of that, when there's a sense of just connecting with the moment, the sense of self is much quieter or even absent, and yet there's still something which is present and open to it. And this is the mystery that starts to go beyond what we can articulate with words. It's easier to say the patterns, right? But what's outside the pattern is much harder to define. And yet that's what the Buddha discovered. That's the cessation. Yeah, so you're getting a taste of that. You're getting a sense of that thinning of self. So if the pattern arises, understanding it, not fighting with it, allowing it to fall away more and more. And also there's a sense of effort starts, changes from trying to overcome it to just relaxing into that stillness. All right, thank you for sharing that. All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Thanks, Tim. I'm just kind of trying to understand. We have dukkha because we're born into this human world, or we have dukkha. Dukkha's built into being a human, but it's not our fault. I mean, but we can work toward the cessation of it. I watch things like this come and rise and fall away in my life a lot. There'll always be new dukkha, won't there? I mean, my knee got better, but my back was worse, or my, what would you say about that?
Yeah, so it's that, I think it's so helpful when we talk about dukkha to not make it some kind of magical thinking that somehow, you know, a fairy godmother is going to wave a wand over me. I'm never going to feel physical pain again. Because sometimes it sounds like that cessation of dukkha. That sounds great. You know, it's like heaven or all these heavenly realms. I don't have this annoying human body that gets old and sick and decrepit and all those things. I don't have to have my heart feel hurt and all those qualities. The Buddha, you look at the Buddha's life and the suttas, I mean, he had back pain, he had digestive issues, you know, he had things which, he had a human body. He experienced loss when his dear disciples passed away. And there's the pain of that. But it's more how we amplify it. So it's kind of a way to kind of get a handle on that. It's like taking the physical pain you just described, the knee pain, the back pain. How much of that is kind of essential, that's just the bare experience of it, and what's added onto it, what's layered onto it. It's tricky because we often relate to the layering as the pain itself, as the suffering itself, instead of actually seeing we've added to it. There's actually this layer. Like I had a friend who had chronic pain, still has chronic pain. But one way he described working with it is when he was able to, in his words, divorce the fear from the pain. Okay, so you have the physical pain, but then there's the projection into the future. Oh, this means I won't be able to do this, or this is the implications, or it's going to keep on getting worse. That's all the fear, the way we've kind of amplified it. But the directness, the direct experience of it is just sensation and pressure, right? So that's one way to play with it. And physical pain is a big teacher. It's, you know, it's a demanding teacher. You have to use it, you know, with care, but start to open to something that's physically hurting and see, okay, can I feel it as sensations? Can I even drop the label of pain itself to open to the direct experience of that? Like, almost like you've never felt this before. What is this like? And notice how the mind wants to add to it, and how it adds to it, and you believe what's added to it, you feel a lot worse. You're suffering more, right? So that's what's meant by that second arrow. Okay, so that's like working with the physical quality of it. You know, we can also talk about the kind of the emotional and mental part, the identification around, you know, that sense of self. And that's really tied with the, you know, the belief in the future tripping and all those qualities. Does that start to make more sense, Kathy? Does that get to your question?
Helpful. Thank you, Tim. I particularly, I remember something I noticed the other day, is that I'm feeling some discomfort. And then something interesting came along and diverted my mind, and I forgot all about it.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's with mindfulness, we'll maybe talk about this when we get to the month of mindfulness. The way we approach something that's painful, it's easy for the way we're looking to actually take the shape or the flavoring of that pain. We don't realize that we're actually looking from it from a place of kind of brittleness or tightness. So I think this is actually a technique that people can use with trauma, is to not go too quickly or too strongly or too one-pointed focused into that it's painful, but actually balance it. Focus on something that's not painful, some other part of the body or something external like sound or smells or some sight. And let the mindfulness start to really connect with that. So it starts to quiet down. And yet there's this, I think something relaxes. You can actually feel or observe, if you're working with someone, the physiological change in them. They take a breath. They settle in a little bit. Their system's more in balance. And we can, you know, they can talk about all the physiological aspects of that, those kind of sympathetic effects, parasympathetic changes. But you can feel that shift. And then from that place, touch into the pain a little bit, just for, you know, a short time, so you can notice from a fresh perspective, and you can go back and forth. So this helps you see, okay, this is what I'm adding to it. This is what I'm amplifying with it. And this is a subtle way that our mindfulness actually can amplify it by we're looking at it and we start to relate to it from a pain mind instead of a mind of equanimity and balance.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Kathy. Same thing with emotions, same thing with mental.
Yeah.
They're just a little more tricky. All right, what else is out there? What else is in the room? Zoom or here?
Hi, Tim.
Hello.
It's Nina.
Hi, Nina.
Can you talk a little bit, you talked about the distortions around the paramis. Can you talk a little about the denial of our humanness?
Mm. I
don't quite understand that.
Yeah, so the denial of our humanness, I think that's a beautiful way to express, you know, one of the fundamental distortions around that. The paramis, because we look at this list and we want to be good practitioners. We want to be good Buddhist or Dharma practitioners or however you frame it. And we want to be like the Buddha. And we say, okay, the Buddha never got impatient, for example. Never, it was only emanating loving kindness all the time. And so then we start to set up this inner tension with the parts of us which are really contracted of heart. And instead of using wisdom to understand it, investigation and mindfulness to really open to that, we adopt basically a self-image that we have to protect and defend and project into the world. Right. So then we're relating to the concept, and we've adopted that concept versus actually being deeply honest with ourselves. So it's tricky because, you know, there's the aspiration of how can I meet this with this loving kindness? How can I meet this moment with patience? But you have to, for myself, I have to really work with that edge of inner tension. And that's this self-honesty. When there's an inner tension, this dissonance with how I really am, with my self-image, it's good to kind of put the brakes and say, okay, this is a really easy place to go into spiritual bypassing and to, because, you know, life is going to eventually win, right? It's going to eventually come out in a way. You know, so, okay, what I like to do is if I'm trying to work with something like patience or loving kindness and I'm really not feeling that, can I bring loving kindness to the fact that I'm not feeling it? Can I be compassionate for my pain around this? Can I be patient with the fact I'm impatient? Right, so that way you're still really working with the parami, but you're not adopting that self-image. And, you know, as we become more attuned to ourselves and sensitive inwardly, we should start to pick up on that dissonance. It's like for myself, as a teacher, you know, it's like I'm supposed to have this, I don't know what you guys think I'm supposed to be, but sometimes there's these ideas that come up. And it's like, okay, I have a choice of kind of enhancing that idea or being honest, you know, showing the humanness, showing the vulnerability, showing my mistakes or my failings, you know. Or I could say, oh, let me show you about all these great things about my practice. So you know, the self-honesty shows that dissonance and that choice point. It happens really quick. There's this quick shift, and that's where this the wise effort is so important. Because how we act starts to reinforce that. It's like these constant choice points. And ideally, truthfulness is kind of a fundamental, it's like I really want to be truthful in this moment. Even if that means saying I'm really impatient right now in this moment. I really have no, I only have hatred for you. I don't have any loving kindness in this moment. You know, there's the discernment, of course, how you express that. But does that kind of help get to your...
Yes.
Your question there?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nina. All right, Laura, let's go with you next.
Oh, hi. Sometimes you recommend a book with the study.
Well, yes.
Can you suggest a book we can follow along with your next topic?
Yeah, for the Four Noble Truths.
Right.
You know, we are going to have a list of resources.
Okay.
That's going to give you some books. One book offhand that comes to mind is Philip Moffat's book. Which one is it? It's the
Dancing with Life.
Dancing with Life. Yes. Yeah, so that's a great book. He really likes these 12 insights that I kind of mentioned. So he brings those forth, and we'll have some other resources that will become. Is it already online? Do you guys know,
yeah,
Judah?
It is.
Do you have a mic?
Right in my hand. Yeah, the annual teaching series has been updated. And so if you look under classes and programs or whatever, and annual, and there's a list of resources in there that you can take a look at. And that Dancing is Life is listed. What the Buddha Taught is one of the books that's listed. There's a lot there.
Great. Oh, great. Thank you.
You are.
And may I ask something else?
Sure.
The five precepts, are you going to have a little talk or something before what we're vowing to on that sixth?
Yes. Yeah, so the three teachers will be framing the precepts and the refuges. We'll, you know, give a little talk around that. And then we'll explain what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Okay.
Both in person and online. Yeah. Let's see, question. Okay, great. If you're online, Melila just put that in the chat, the link to that. Yeah, perfect. All right, anyone back here in the room? Yes, great.
I was curious, the word tana, I think you said, was it craving?
Yes, tanha.
Tanha, craving. Yep. Is that just about craving, I guess you could say, positive stuff? The reason I ask is the first thing that came to my mind is I'm trying to reduce my screen usage. Mm-hmm. And so I'm noticing that I'm really fiending for it. Like I really feel my brain constantly I want it. Even though it's really unpleasant and stresses me out.
Right.
Is that the same thing or is that something different?
I would say it's, you know, tanha, there's a way it's described in this second noble truth. It's also part of the links of dependent origination, the 12 links. And so tanha is this important link where we take sense data and we try to, it kind of drives us into formation of self, basically. Right?
Huh.
But I think it's really helpful to notice this almost physiological wanting of something.
Yeah.
Because it starts to give you this way of identifying the more subtle ways, like we talked about, with that self-identification. Because when we get down to it, there's a little hunger just to be. Technically, there's kind of three types of tanha. One is of sense pleasure, which I think that would be part of it, mm-hmm. that you just described. There's also the hunger to become. Mm-hmm. So become a positive sense of self, like, look at me, I'm so great. Mm-hmm. There's also the hunger not to become. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so diminished, I'm inadequate, I'm a failure. Mm-hmm. There's this hunger to kind of step into that self-belief. But I think it's like the working with those kind of almost physiological or that you know, you're like, you're detoxing kind
yes.
of. It's like, I want that. It yeah. kind of teaches you something about how to recognize that. Because sometimes practice can get really subtle and quiet when you start to get in this terrain of that hunger to self, to form into that. Mm-hmm. And there's different kind of ways we kind of get a handle on that. But recognizing, oh, there's just, I want to be doing something. I want to be interacting. I mm-hmm. want to know. I want to be in control. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like a physiological hunger.
Mm-hmm.
It's very quiet in some of these subtle states, but then there's, okay, what do I release into? What do I let go of?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that helps us open to that place outside of self.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Right. Anyone else like to ask or share anything? Last time, nice chance this year.
Actually, I just wanted to add on to something that is the craving to feel good, the craving to not feel bad, and the craving to not. This has been something that's been happening. If I have a lot, if I put a lot of pressure on myself to do something, to learn something, and then when I feel like I'm not getting anywhere or I lose my motivation or whatever, I have a hard time having compassion towards myself because I want to get to this place so bad, and then I bring it back on myself as though there's something wrong with me, and it's that selfing, you know, it's that horrible selfing that and I shouldn't say horrible selfing. I appreciate, Nina, what you said about the denial of self, because, you know, I think that often I can be in that place that I have to overcome myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So anyway, if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Sure, yeah, thank you for sharing that. So honestly, it's I think of the Four Noble Truths, like dukkha catches our attention. We see that there's suffering. And how do we work with it? Kind of, there's wide range. And that's one of the beauties of so many teachings. And especially when you're feeling that sense of that self harshness or judgment, I think it's often helpful to really interject compassion into that. Because, I mean, how often have we judged the fact we're judging ourselves? You know, or it's like, oh no, I'm judging myself. I'm judging my judgment again. You know, and it's like the way we're, yeah, exactly. Anything we do from that place just makes it worse, right? It's like it's a storm going and everything we throw at it makes the storm bigger. It's like the tornado has more things to throw around now. It's like, okay, I need to switch modes, you know, and I think so that's a hard place to get into because it has this strong momentum. It was, okay, I can't keep acting the same way. And that's kind of a healthy distrust of our natural instincts or patterns. You know, this is like, because we all have these patterns that we learned for various reasons. It's like, okay, let me really deeply pause. Let me come into the moment and check in with the heart. You know, maybe there's some level of compassion. It's like, okay, I'm not how I want to be in this moment. This is not how I want the moment to be. Can I feel compassion for that? That compassion then starts to open up really wise effort. Wise, you get more skillful. How do you deal with that? And each of those choices of not kind of adding fuel to the fire, as it were, starts to loosen the momentum of that. You know, and that's what's beautiful. That's what we talked about, things falling away, is because we've stopped adding that fuel. And there's a new thing that arises that's more compassionate, more skillful.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. Cheryl. All right, maybe one or two more if there's anyone. All right. Okay, we got two over there in the corner.
So this just kind of ties into the subject of like getting upset with yourself for, like you said, judging yourself or something like that.
Yes.
Kind of a practical application where I see myself doing that is like I'll have like road rage or something. You know, somebody cuts you off in traffic and I find myself like I'm able to come back to myself and my awareness and be like, okay, I don't want to act like that in the future. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in like other instances, it leads to me like cutting off the emotion and not feeling it. So
yeah.
If you could talk a little bit about how you balance feeling what you're supposed to feel without kind of cutting off those feelings, mm-hmm. and still being present with them. I guess.
Yeah, that's a great application of the practice. Is, you know, how do we not deny or cut it off, but yet not act from it? You know, where is that line? And it is challenging because, you know, like these moments often when, like, let's use your example, road rage, is like often it's like it loads up so quickly, right? Someone cuts us off or scared, and we get, you know, it's like the whole pattern is loaded up. And yet we don't want to act from it. Sometimes in the middle of that, you can start to just say, okay, it's like you're trying to step back a little bit to observe yourself. You know, like road rage, probably the underlying thing is fear that started it. And then maybe there's anger or laid over that. So maybe go back to that fear. You can add some positive ways of practicing. Like sometimes when I see someone do that, driving in a really reckless way, I say, may you be safe. You know, I feel that concern for their well-being and the people they might harm. So that's a way that starts to, that's kind of that positive action that comes in. And it's, depending on the situation, sometimes you have to kind of do it almost after the fact, because you, like, your system just is primed to react a certain way, right? So maybe the not acting is enough to quiet it down, but you're doing a little repression while you're doing it. So after the fact, just spend some time kind of sitting with it or walking with it, kind of letting it air out, letting it be felt more fully. So you can kind of feel all the different emotions, all the mental states, all the self-beliefs that arise around that. The next time that arises, you're going to have more versatility and more ability to see it sooner without being lost.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I really appreciated your explanation of wise view. I think, can you check my understanding on it? We can take the Four Noble Truths as like not a statement of metaphysical fact, but as here's a perspective you can adopt. And if you do, if you like stipulate that some of your suffering is caused by craving, then that leads to, oh, we can like adjust, we can follow this eightfold path and like get rid of some of that suffering. Like see it as a recommendation rather than as a statement of universal truth.
That the Four Noble Truths are a recommendation versus a... It's like there's different ways we work with it. You know, right now, the way you're describing it, it's like your mind's kind of making sense of it, right? It's trying to figure out how it fits in. And that's where you work with it, that where it is right now. Eventually it starts to become like more of an intuitive sense. It's an intuitive way of understanding, okay, this path leads to suffering, this path leads to freedom. It can be as simple as that. And you just start to understand that more clearly. So sometimes the Buddhist teachings can kind of get in our way because we want to, there's a lot you can study, right? There's a lot of lists. And it kind of gets in a little bit away of our practice sometimes. But how can I start to see that? Maybe take one chunk. Let me really understand dukkha in a full way, right? If you understand one of these, you're going to start to understand all of them, right? And so that starts, the view is almost something that kind of comes up. Again, there's different ways we can think of it intellectually, but I think ultimately it's kind of what's the programming that we're running at that point. It's like the operating system in the computer. Does it load up in a way that's supportive of freedom and the releasing of suffering, or is it loading up in a way that creates more suffering?
So is it correct then that we kind of get past the view eventually and get into just feeling the path?
I would probably say it's not so much we get past the view, but we more integrate it so deeply it becomes the way we see and perceive the world.
Thank you.
But then, you know, for a long time we're practicing seeing it from that way, and that's a big fruit of practice. That's a big part of practice. How can I see the situation from a wiser way? How can I take my understanding of the Four Noble Truths and apply it in this way? You know, there'd be lots of confusion, lots of trial and error and practicing. But by doing that, just like with the road rage, over time it becomes more and more integrated.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, maybe one more if there's anyone. All right, there's a lot of good, rich questions. Thank you for having the courage to ask questions. I know it's sometimes hard to do that, you know, to put your voice out into the room and be vulnerable that way. But yet, you know, it does help us really understand the teachings and the practice in a more full, deep way. So thank you for those who asked questions, and thanks for everyone's kind attention. All right, so I wish you all a happy new year, and be safe, and hopefully we'll see you on the 6th, Monday the 6th. All right, thank you all.